Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. So I came across a story that kind of reminded me of Dead Poets Society, kind of reminded me of a Hellfire Club kind of blueprint in a way. And it's really interesting, so I just kind of had to share it with you. And it's about the world's oldest ghost club and a secret society that branched from it called the Everlastings. So what is the Old Ghost Club? So the Ghost Club is a paranormal investigation and research organization that's widely believed to be the oldest such organization in the world. You know, they remained a selective and secretive organization of convinced believers for whom psychic phenomena and hauntings were an established fact. And the club's roots go back to 1855, to Cambridge, where fellows at Trinity College began to discuss ghosts and psychic phenomena. Launched officially in London in 1862, it counted Charles Dickens, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, W.B. Yeats, and Siegfried Sassoon as members. The club was 7 years in the making, having started as a conversation about ghosts between Cambridge fellows at Trinity College in 1855. On paper, the group appeared to be, you know, Victorian Ghostbusters. You know, who are you going to call? Well, you couldn't call then. Who are you going to write? Behind the scenes, they were into a little bit of everything. Naturally, people muttered opinions of the club under their breath, but since the club included, you know, luminaries among its ranks, people assumed it was knowledge-based and left it alone. Now, I said, you know, Charles Dickens was a member, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, you know, then you had people from the British military, Peter Cushing, you had a bunch of colonels, it just... Every kind of person you could imagine was part of this ghost club. And they investigated spiritual phenomena and the paranormal. They were very interested in the Davenport Brothers Traveling Magic Show. And I've put a photo up at the so you can see kind of the Davenport Brothers. And the brothers claimed to be magicians and performed with a spirit cabinet they marked as being able to communicate with the dead. One of the club's earliest investigations was of the Davenport brothers and their spirit cabinet hoax. Now, the Ghost Club rarely, if ever, shared the results of their investigations, but the one time they broke their own rule was when the club challenged the Davenport's claim of contacting the dead. They made it known they didn't believe the brothers. Outside of this, the club investigated all kinds of spiritualist phenomena. They just kept their findings internal, as most secret societies do. So some of the investigations that the group conducted were Borley Church, Jingle Hall, the Queen's House, Glamis Castle, Winchester Theater, the Ancient Ram Inn in Watton-under-Edge. You know, there's tons of them. And the club remained a selective, private organization of men that met monthly. Membership was always kept below 80 people. No women were admitted. And the men were required to have genuine interest in ghost hunting and believe in ghosts, as they didn't want to attract skeptics. Investigations into the spirit world were referred to as physical research, and the growing popularity of spiritualism at this time attracted people like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and Sigmund Freud to the meetings. And members felt that the cloak of the Ghost Club gave them freedom to conduct the research and conversation outside the scope and norms of everyday society. At each meeting of the Ghost Club, a list of all the members, dead or alive, was read. Deceased members were said to sometimes make their presence felt during this activity. Sir Arthur Gray of this college in Cambridge immortalized the Ghost Club as the Everlasting Club in 1919, a ghost story that around Cambridge some still believe to be true. Today, the club is referred to as the Club of Dead Men. Now, following the death of Charles Dickens, the Ghost Club kind of became inactive during the 1870s. It was revived on All Saints Day, 1882, but when things are revived, they're never really the same. Two self-proclaimed psychic mediums, came along and not only tried to revive the Ghost Club, but initially claimed to be the original founders of it, without acknowledging the club's true origins. As it turns out, the men were linked to the Society for Psychical Research, with whom there was an initial overlap since the two clubs had been founded at the same time. So this rivalry group looks to consume the now defunct group. It came across as spiteful considering that at least one of the men ultimately resigned from the Society for Psychical Research to devote himself full-time to the Ghost Club. He had wanted what they had all along. An interest and curiosity remained high over the early 1900s, and the group still lured in the big shots. You had like Frederick Blybond joined in 1925, and his investigations into spiritualism at Glastonbury became infamous. Bond flipped around a lot. He left the Ghost Club and became active in the American Society for Psychical Research before moving on to become ordained in the Catholic Church, only to rejoin the Ghost Club again in 1935. Now, why these guys bounce between these two clubs is, you know, a deep dive within itself. Some of them even bounced in and out of the Magician's Club. You know, maybe they just couldn't get along. Maybe they just wanted to do their own thing. Now, the 20th century group shifted from like ghoulish seance room investigations to academically based laboratory science, real research. It was far removed from what the original Ghost Club gathered to talk about. There was less psychic research and spirit communicating. This led to, you know, falling membership, and the club closed the doors yet again in 1936. The 20th century Ghost Club books were gifted to the British Museum under the condition they remained sealed until 1962, under a confidentiality clause. Less than 18 months after the Ghost Club called it quits, though, another person tried to relaunch it as a dinner society that offered dinner talks with psychics and mediums. Sounds kind of finance-driven, you know, in my opinion. And the club members became even broader. This time, they included women. They also welcomed skeptics into the group to peer-review paranormal topics. This leg of the club lasted, you know, pretty much through the 1960s before they folded yet again. So by 1993, the club members couldn't pull their act together and the club underwent a period of infighting, which resulted in the president at the time forming his own new ghost society. So moral of the story was never, ever, ever the same. They should have left it alone after the original seven perished. Now, how did, you know, the old Ghost Club develop into these seven everlastings? Well, the Ghost Club was broad, right? But you had these seven original members of the Ghost Club who were so close that they decided to form their own secret society, kind of within a secret society. It splintered off from the Ghost Club. And they called themselves the Everlastings. And the seven members did not all attend the same university, but they all had university ties. They saw themselves as elitist, from good pedigree, with high IQ and scientific background. And this particular seven enjoyed partying. So how they really spent their club time and how they saw themselves versus how their schoolmates saw them kind of led to delusions of grandeur. You know, on paper, they claimed they investigated events that were paranormal or spiritual in nature, but most schoolmates remember them partying and acting wild and walking a fine line of getting expelled from university. So the Everlastings included Henry Davenport, a Trinity Fellow, Alan Dermot, founder and president, who was a Cambridge physician, Francis Witherington, James Harvey, William Catherston, and Charles Balassus. The oldest of the seven was a 30-year-old Irishman who was working towards his graduate degree. The youngest member was a 22-year-old trust fund heir to a long line of dualists. There was the respected medical doctor, of course, and one member was a Cambridgeshire squire's son. And there were also three university fellows of various colleges at Cambridge. And the members were young and easily manipulated by the eldest member and president of the club, Alan Dermot. It was his idea for them to form the Everlastings. Upon graduation from university, each Everlasting member made an oath to meet at the same time every year on All Souls' Day, jokingly adding, even if they are dead. Now, Dermot's club supposedly became the model for the Hellfire clubs. Dermot's was just more anemic. The Everlastings supposedly spent the majority of their time wasted on booze and dreaming out loud. The rules of the club were as follows. Club membership was everlasting. No member, once inducted, could ever drop his membership, and there would be no members admitted after the induction of the original seven. Living members were referred to as corporeal members. Deceased members were incorporeal. Alan Dermot was president for life. The next eldest was secretary, and the pecking order kind of descended in rank from there. and the club kept a scrupulous minute book that was held at all times by the secretary. And as members became dead, then the next eldest would obtain the secretary position. And these members met all the time to drink and dine together, but the oath and obligation required that all seven members punctually attend at 10 p.m. on November 2nd, the Feast of All Souls. This old tradition, important yearly dinner, would be held at different members' homes based on a rotation order. Any member who failed to attend the dinner would be fined by the president. Now, there's no current documents that indicate what that fine was, but the minute book reflects that fines were paid, meaning they were prone to not show up. It seems that at least two of the members fell into scandal due to getting way too wasted and acting poorly. The university didn't like it and expelled them until they could straighten up their act. Now, this didn't stop the members from meeting each other. Everything continued on schedule, and the two members went on to redeem themselves and return to campus. By the time things turned around on campus, things were supposedly taking a supernatural detour straight to hell when it came to attending the Feast of Souls, the year of 1743. That year, it was the doctor's turn to host the dinner. So you had the president, Alan Dermot, and five of the others were present. Henry Davenport was excused from the dinner due to a commitment with the army. He didn't tell them he wasn't coming. They knew he was serving in Germany in the Dettingen campaign. When he hadn't showed up, that was that. His absence and subsequent fine was recorded in the minute book at the beginning of the dinner. The entry reads, it's in Latin, so give me a break, Multatis propter absentiam per presidentem, Hen Davenport. The books reflect that each member printed their name and address as proof of presence. After the book business was squared away, dinner was served. In the middle of dinner, the club president passed a decanter around the table for each member to take a drink. Of course, there was a break in the chain due to the empty place setting of Henry Davenport. As the tale goes, out of the soft candlelight there rose a hand that lifted the decanter and filled the glass that had been set for Davenport. As the other members watched in horror, they didn't understand what was going on. How was it happening? Was it a trick or a ghost? If it was a ghost, why was there a ghost of their absent friend? Davenport slowly manifested before their eyes with a bloody uniform. Then they understood. The only solace was that he was grinning. Whatever happened, Davenport was pleased as punch about it. The next part of the story is where the skeptics kind of will tap out, and the believers will continue listening. Remember, this is the Everlasting Club, the oldest ghost club. Supposedly, Davenport said, "Gentlemen, I kept my promise. I was killed in a skirmish today, yet here I am, dead though I may be. I've kept my promise. Will you keep yours?" Nothing else further was written about that dinner. The minute book was not updated until the following day. The next passage reads, "Secretary noted Henry Davenport by a cannon shot. Became a dead member November 3rd, 1743. It seems that Alan Dermot, the club president, had been living in a war zone as well. During the dinner, he listed his address as Court of His Royal Highness. Keep in mind the dinner date was November 2nd, and he was supposedly very much in attendance. Now get this. The minute book reflects the secretary wrote on October 28th, 1743, "On this day, we receive word that the president became dead in a duel with a French chevalier. Good God shield us from it." That puts a dead president sitting at their dinner party with another dead guy who's pouring himself a drink. You know, I could be on board with these people being completely wasted and believing they're seeing one dead man sitting at their table because, you know, if they're grief-stricken, then maybe they're so drunk they're seeing what they want to see. But seeing two men? Wild. So you had these five surviving members, and they are extremely unnerved. They still met for occasional drinks and socials, but they formally voted to cease meeting for the Feast of Souls in November. They agreed to abandon the tradition for the next 5 years. By the sixth year, another member had died, and the members handled this by not meeting for another 18 years. I mean, at that point, are they even a club anymore? If they're giving it up, what's the point? For a group that studied death and the supernatural, they weren't handling it well, which makes you wonder what they really studied. Now, in 1766, Francis Witherington, the club's 18-year secretary, died, passing the minute book to the next eldest, James Harvey, who died only 1 month later. The book passed to William Catherston, and guess what? He passed away only months later, too. That left only one remaining member, Charles Bellesis. He wrote in the Minute Book that on May 18, 1766, he, the last survivor, was now secretary of the Everlasting Club. My question is this: as the last member, who passed the book to Bellasis so quickly? Now, Bellasis believed in his mind that the dinner could not be postponed because the vote was up and there were no members left to vote. He had to hold the dinner. He felt great guilt. At least one member had died of suicide. Another member was debatable because he had expressed fear of facing any other types of ghosts at this dinner. The others died tragically. He believed he had to set their spirits free. Now, Bellasis lived on Cow Lane, in an apartment at the top of a staircase located only one door over from this college. It was apparently considered school housing. On November 2nd, 1766, on Feast of Souls Day, he prepared his room for a dinner party for ghosts, locked all the doors in his apartment, both inner and outer, and waited. Dead on at 10 o'clock, as the club oath has always suggested, apparently Bellasis was throwing a party. With whom? Your guess is as good as mine. Ghosts? But the people in the college awoke to the sound of breaking glass, furniture crashing, drunken screams, and blushing blasphemy. By midnight, all was quiet. Oddly, not one person had walked over to Cow Lane and ventured up the staircase to check on Bellasis the evening of the commotion. The schoolmaster had heard it all, laid awake all night, annoyed at the relapse of Bellasis's bad behavior. So the next day, the university schoolmaster and staff angrily marched over and banged on his door. When he didn't answer, I mean, it was school property, so they pried the door open with crowbars and entered. The smell of death hit them when they entered the threshold. It took their breath away. There were seven chairs strewn about the room, which was a disaster. Bellasis was sitting at the head of a long oak table, leaning over the red Minute Book, with his arms shielding his eyes as if attempting to protect himself. He had been dead for hours. The body was cold. The Minute Book entry from the previous rowdy evening reflected that all seven Everlastings had been in attendance. All had printed their name in their own individual handwriting, signifying their attendance. Not a one included an address. Underneath the attendance list in Club President Alan Dermot's handwriting was a Latin phrase, which translated, I won't read the Latin this time, fined by the president for neglect of his obligations, Charles Bellasis. Creepy, right? All of it. So the Minute Book was secured by the master of the college, who is believed to be the only person who read the book in confidence. He obviously shared bits and pieces with colleagues, but he never revealed the entire nature of the book's contents. The scandalous circumstances that cloaked the club and book could have caused the university grief, so he made a decision to shield people from public scandal. It's said that he destroyed the book. Not understanding what to make of the Minute Book's last entries or Bellasis' death, administrators would not permit anyone to live in Charles Bellasis' room at the top of Cow Lane. It remained vacant, with its windows bricked up and door padlocked until 1924, when it was finally converted into a store. There were only a few strange occurrences on Cow Lane that could be considered borderline hauntings. After the 1940s, it reportedly stopped, and there have been no reports of everlasting ghost haunts since. You have to decide for yourself how much of the Everlasting's story is true. The story became so famous that the master principal of this college in Cambridge, Sir Arthur Grey, wrote a supposed fictional story about the Everlasting Club, which appeared in Tedious Brief Tales of Granta and Grammarie in 1919. After reading the story, many people believed it sheds truth on the actions of an elite group within the old ghost club. And this could explain why the story mirrors the rules and special meeting dates of the Ghost Club, especially November 2nd. I mean, that's no coincidence. It reminds me of those books that murderers publish after they're acquitted, one of those, well, if I did it sort of deals. The Club of Dead Men, as it's referred today, is a story and secret society that leaves more questions than answers. If it's all a joke, why did Sir Arthur Grey, who was, you know, the headmaster of this college for nearly 40 years, decide to publish any type of story related to a real ghost club? Most schoolmasters would have steered clear of such scandalous ghost lore unless he felt compelled to put it out there in whatever format he could get by with. Even journalist James Wentworth Day, who loves a good ghost story, published a sinister article about the Club of Dead Men. Day claims he studied with Sir Arthur Couch at Cambridge in 1920 and heard the story directly from him. He said, quote, "I have before me a transcript of the minute book, which, though it is in a recent handwriting, presents a singular array of facts that I must ask you to accept them as veracious. When all's said and done, I'll say this. If it's not a true story, then dang it, it ought to be." Now, the Everlasting Club still has a modern following to this day, with no links to any of the original seven people who made the club what it was. Today's club offers kind of a broad, seemingly all-inclusive membership where it appears they swap trendy supernatural tales through a bi-monthly newsletter. But I didn't dig too far into the membership, but from the outside looking in, the reading material focuses on people like Fritz Lieber and Stephen King and Bram Stoker. Authors like that. Real trendy. So I'm going to read you the story by Sir Arthur Gray. There is a chamber in Jesus College, the existence of which is probably known to few who are now resident, and fewer still have penetrated into it or even seen its interior. It is on the right hand of the landing on the top floor of the staircase, which for some forgotten story connected with it is traditionally called Cow Lane. The padlock, which secures its massive oaken door, is very rarely unfastened, for the room is bare and unfurnished. Once it served as a place of deposit for superfluous kitchenware, but even that use has passed from it, and it is now left to undisturbed solitude and darkness. For I should say that it is entirely cut off from the light of the outer day by the walling up, sometime in the 18th century, of its single window, and such light as ever reaches it comes from the door when rare occasion causes it to be opened. Yet at no extraordinarily remote day, this chamber has evidently been tenanted, and before it was given up to the darkness, was comfortably fitted, according to the standard of comfort which was known in college in the days of George II. There's still a roomy fireplace, before which logs have been stretched and legs have been stretched, and wine and gossip have circulated in the days of Whigs. For the room is spacious, and it was lighted by the window looking eastward over the fields and common. It must have been a cheerful place. Let me state in brief prosaic outline the circumstances which account for the gloom and solitude in which this room has remained now for nearly a century and a half. In the second quarter of the 18th century, the university possessed a great variety of clubs of a social kind. There were clubs in college parlors and clubs in private rooms or in inns and coffee houses, clubs flavored with politics, clubs that were clerical, clubs purporting to be leaned, learned, and literary. Whatever their professed particularity, the aim of each was liveliness. Some of them, which included undergraduates as well as seniors, were dissipated enough, and in their limited provincial way, aped the way of such clubs as the Hellfire Club of London. Among these last was one which was at once more select and of more evil fame than any of its fellows. By a singular accident presently to be explained, the minute book of this club, including the years from 1738 to 1766, came into the hands of the master of Jesus College, and though, so far as I'm aware, it is no longer existing, I have before me a transcript of it, which, though it is in recent handwriting, presents in bald shape such a singular array of facts that I must ask you to accept them as veracious. The original book is described as 40 pages in volume, bound in red leather, and fastened with red silken strings. The last entry in the book is dated November 2nd, 1766. The club in question was called the Everlasting Club, a name sufficiently explained by its rules set forth in the pocketbook. Its number was limited to seven, and it would seem that its members were all young men, between 22 and 30. One of them was a fellow commoner of Trinity. Three of them were fellows of colleges, among whom I should especially mention a fellow of Jesus named Charles Bellesis. Another was a landed proprietor in the county, and the sixth was a young Cambridge physician. The founder and president of the club was the Honorable Alan Dermot, who, as the son of an Irish peer, had obtained a nobleman's degree in the university and lived in idleness in the town. Very little is known of his life and character, but that little is highly in his disfavor. He was killed in a duel in Paris in the year 1743, under circumstances which I need not particularize, but which point to an exceptional degree of cruelty and wickedness in the slain man. And then he talks about the same rules, kind of, that I talked about before. I mean, it's crazy, you know? And even if the names of the actual Everlastings were changed to fictional names and the dates altered to protect identities, you know, obviously Sir Arthur Grey knew of a real story worth telling. He put a lot of detail into each of his characters. What could we reasonably expect from the oldest ghost club that mixed, you know, magicians and alchemists and alcoholics and scientists? Why was there ever a boarded up room at the college? A room so secret that it was locked away for well over a century. Now, the story is so interesting that it did inspire the episode Devil's Alphabet from the first season of the television series The Twilight Zone. If you want to read the whole story, I didn't want to just read for reading's sake, but I would read it. It's by Sir Arthur Grey. It's called The Everlasting Club, and you can find it online pretty easily. You can send me a little message. Maybe, you know what I can do? I can just post it to the thing in case you want to read it. All right, you guys, I will talk to you later.